Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for August 15th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast, and in it, artificial life forms are made to evolve basic memory, touch screens appear to be open to attacks based on the fingertip smudges left on them, the future of 3D printing, and Google and Verizon actually announced what it is that they were getting up to around network neutrality. All of this and more. First, though, obviously I'm back from my San Francisco trip. I'm still in the process of recovering. That was a very fast trip out, but it was long enough to really mess with my internal clock. So I haven't posted any thoughts, personal or professional, about the trip, although I will say that it was excellent. I very much enjoyed myself and got a lot of value out of it. I hopefully will get some thoughts up on the website about that this coming week. Also, I wanted to start giving a heads up that DragonCon is coming up. That's Labor Day weekend. That's September 5th this year. And I'm going to take off a little bit more time this year around that. So there'll be no news show on the 29th and no news show on the 5th. That's the Sunday of that long weekend. And there will not be a feature cast on the 1st. And there may or may not be, as in years past, on the Wednesday returning on the 8th, depending on what audio I'm able to capture while I'm there. I'm hopefully going to come back with at least two bits of audio. One, the copyright panel that I've done repeatedly in years past and has always been such a success. And hopefully I'll get a chance to catch up with my good friend Randy Chertko from Beatnik Turtle and see what he and the guys in the band have been up to, as well as chewing the fat on issues copyright, Creative Commons, and technology related. I'll continue to remind you in the run-up in the coming weeks to those particular dates that I'll miss for putting shows out so that you can plan accordingly if you want to drop other things into your podcast feed. And of course, if you're going to be at DragonCon or you're in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area, please do let me know. I'd be very interested in maybe organizing some sort of small meetup while I'm there. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. The first alert that I have, I heard through Glenn Moody on his Identica timeline, and this is news of an Android Trojan spreading and causing mischief over texting. This is a Computer Weekly piece that, according to which, SMS Trojans are already common on smartphones. The idea is the malware tricks a user into installing it, that's the very nature of a Trojan, but it then sends text to premium rate numbers, and the attackers collect the charges on those numbers, profiting from the actions of the installed malware. This past week, Kaspersky Labs identified the first such Trojan to affect Android-based phones. The app in question is not in the market, so it's not an issue of it slipping past Google's watchful eye. A user would have to encounter it on a malicious website and install the .apk file that's distributed bare on such a site. It claims to be a media player. This is actually a very common tactic for Trojans on all platforms. Kaspersky Labs suggests that attacks like these will increase. Android has been growing at an accelerating rate, recently surpassing the iPhone by some sales metrics. It's pretty much common sense that larger targets are more likely to be attacked. Google, for their part, is skeptical of the risk given the permission model of Android. On installing any application on that system, the user is presented with what actions that software will take during the course of it running. That includes making calls and sending text messages. A savvy user should doubt that something labeled as a media player needs to make a call to reach anyone or to send an SMS message. However, the Trojan may be spreading as a consequence of click fatigue. This is a common phenomenon on Windows, for example, even lampooned very famously in Apple's Get a Mac campaign, or I'm a Mac, I'm a PC campaign. Kaspersky, of course, says it's releasing a product to protect against this threat, so the truth here may be closer to Google's view, as they have less reason to inflate the threat to drive sales of a defending product. More reasonable advice is to point out that there is no reason for a legitimate site, really, to encode media in a format other than the ones already well supported on most platforms. If you're asked to install a media player to access something, then the good money is on the fact that that's some form of an attack. The other security story I wanted to chat about was news of a vulnerability in the 1.0 version of the OpenSSL library. According to The Age, this was uncovered by security researcher Georgi Guninsky. The vulnerability is exploitable by a server sending a malformed certificate to a client, so a web server sending more specifically to a browser, although SSL is not just used in web servers and web browsers. That's just the most common example. Usually this would cause the client server to crash, but also apparently, according to the research, this can be exploited to execute injected code. That makes it a very severe flaw. Guninsky included a sample certificate in his findings to demonstrate the problem as he disclosed it. The H tested the sample provided, but only got a warning of an invalid certificate. The problem affects the 1.0 branch, as I said at the outset, of OpenSSL. While that library itself is in very widespread use, the version most commonly installed is still 0.9, so the install base for the newer version apparently is still rather small. So while there isn't any word on a fix yet, given how few systems have 1.0 installed, there is time yet to develop one. The issue is being actively discussed on the OpenSSL developer list, so hopefully a patch will be forthcoming. Odds are good this will be fixed well before the number of users upgrade to 1.0 and start to make that more critical. This is a good reminder that the impact of a flaw is only part of the risk. A critical break that isn't very common is often less concerning than a shallower exploit that is hit with considerable frequency. A further silver lining is that most systems, typically Linux distributions, that do use OpenSSL do so through a managed software repository. Odds are good those few using the affected version will get a security fix promptly after it is developed and tested. Here are the news that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website, thecommandline.net. My interest in artificial life stems from my first reading of Mitch Waldrop's book, Complexity. Framing emerging complexity in terms of life makes sense. It resonates with how life generally trends towards more interesting states over time. Artificial life forms are also hackable. You can indirectly inspire changes through altering the environment, or reach directly into their code, their virtual genome, to see what tweaks yield what changes, exploring the space of interesting outcomes. This fascination is actually pretty common among hackers. In Stephen Levy's book, Hackers, some of the early tinkerers at MIT are utterly fascinated with Tim Conway's life, one of the first artificial life systems capable of producing truly complex patterns. Eric Raymond has even recommended the form of a glider from life as a sample or simple icon for hackers to bear as a signal of their interest. The glider pattern is one of the ones that can self-replicate in life's simple environment. I was instantly curious to learn more on seeing Slashdot's link to a New Scientist article discussing the evolution of memory in an artificial life system. The article is behind a paywall, but if you search for its exact title, you can find the full text of the article as I did, or look for the August 4th issue of New Scientist on newsstands. What the article covers is a set of related experiments at Michigan State University using an artificial life system to try to shed some light into how memory actually evolves in the brain. The system used, Avida, is an indirect descendant of the computer game Core Wars, as it happens, another hacker favorite. In that game, players wrote small programs that battled to the last survivor. The lineage of research systems inspired by the game added capabilities useful for analysis of how simulations actually unfolded. Artificial life is a useful complement to studying biological systems for those added capabilities because it can be replayed, it can be tweaked, and taken apart at its lowest level. What most of these projects found is that memory serves as a navigation aid. In one instance, the researchers set up an environment with a food gradient. At one end, the virtual food was scarce and in small quantities. Moving gradually to the other end of the space, food increased. Starting with the simplest organisms possible, they eventually developed the trick, through evolution, through random mutation, of remembering the food in the last space that the organisms occupied as they moved across that virtual grid of cells. Memory then allowed for relative comparisons, gauging whether food increased or decreased as the organism moved. It's not hard to see how even the simplest form of memory ultimately provided a huge evolutionary advantage. The article also discusses the overlap with artificial intelligence, especially related efforts at MSU exploring evolved brains used to control actual robots. Traditionally, AI research has tried to model minds or subcomponents of minds in a more top-down fashion, modeling off of a working biological mind. The bottom-up approach is already capable of, as the article explains, building effective, if minimal, brains. The future of evolving brains approaching human complexity is quite promising. It makes more sense to me to encode simpler rules and encourage complexity than to drive backwards through an already complex system, which would require understanding, which is hard to come by, and building, which is even harder, all the intermediate rules and systems. Robert Pennock of MSU will be presenting on some of the projects from that university at an annual artificial life conference in Denmark. I encourage you to read the whole article if you can find it, as the projects are quite diverse and there is much more detail on each effort than I've talked to in my short summary. The next story is news of a former John Doe who challenged FBI surveillance of his ISP, now being freed at least partially from a gag order. Kim Zetter at Wired explains the case of Nick Merrill, a security consultant and owner of a small ISP. On receiving a national security letter demanding customer records, he decided to fight the FBI in court on behalf of his customers, believing that their privacy was worth preserving. I already knew that the NSLs do not require a warrant. This is one of the problems with these letters, thus failing to rise to the same standard of probable cause and judicial oversight. What I did not realize is that they also come with a lifelong gag order. As Zetter portrays very clearly in the article, Merrill couldn't discuss, even with his closest acquaintances and family, the ordeal he was going through to challenge the letter. Violating the gag order can be punished with up to 5 years in jail. This secrecy increases the risk that letters will be abused. Zetter points out that an audit by the Justice Department determined that such abuses were occurring with shocking frequency. Arguably, in talking to his attorney, Merrill could have been accused of violating the gag order accompanying his letter. It doesn't make allowance for due process. I suspect, as Merrill himself avers, that right to due process trumps the secrecy of these letters, but that's not how the law that supports them is actually crafted. I think that you wouldn't be hard-pressed to find a judge who would see it consistent with Merrill's view in accessing his attorney and trying to take proper action here. A judge at the end of last month lifted the gag order, at least partially, after the FBI pretty much let its push for information lapse. He isn't sharing everything about the case yet. He can't. What he does explain in about this letter is troubling enough. Not surprisingly, the FBI's demand for information was overly broad. This is exactly the sort of abuse a judge is supposed to prevent in their role in issuing traditional warrants. Law enforcers are meant to be prevented by judicial oversight from being able to troll for anything and everything, things that are not necessarily related to the charges or the case at hand. Ordinarily, they have to prove justification for violating a suspect's privacy. Merrill thankfully stood by his principles from start to finish. He is clearly sharing his story as much as he can in hopes of inspiring others to do the same where they can. As he shares more information, hopefully he will draw more attention to the problems that arise from these national security letters. The lifting of the gag order, as I've said, is only partial, and as the article points out, getting that much was fraught with threats from the FBI about harming national security, so it was not a very easy thing to pull off. Merrill's case did help get congressional amendment of the law so that recipients have more right to challenge these letters. At the same time, as I've mentioned on the blog, the Obama administration is seeking to expand the scope of these letters. Merrill's role in tackling these letters continues. He has since started an educational organization, the Calix Institute, to inform those in the telecoms and technology industries on best practices for protecting customer privacy. This whole case highlights how the secrecy around the national security letters has a secondary effect, which may or may not have been intentional. Now that Merrill is able to talk about some details, it will undoubtedly encourage more sharing and challenges to these unchecked letters. If the secrecy was allowed to remain or even expand, it would chill these challenges that are critical to preserving our constitutional rights. If you have any kind of touchscreen device, you are well familiar with how easily they smudge. Slashdot links to a PC Pro article discussing some research that attempts to recover information from the pattern of residue left on these screens. Work done at the University of Pennsylvania was presented at the USENIX Security Conference. It isn't surprising that they were successfully able to recover Android unlock patterns. Those phones require you to swipe, connecting on-screen dots in a particular way, forming a rough geometric shape, and if you get it correct, it unlocks the phone and grants access. That they were able to achieve a 92% success rate with just a camera and your average computer is surprising for how few resources and how little effort it took for such a high rate. Wiping the screen only works if you really scrub it, if you completely remove any latent residue. They were able to recover prints after casual cleaning, like a single swipe with a cleaning cloth, or just the incidental cleaning that might occur from placing a smartphone in your pocket and taking it out again. The researchers think the technique could be applied to any touch screens. That would include PIN recovery from ATMs or even possibly recovering votes from electronic voting systems with touch screens. I'm inferring there's a limit to the complexity of the recovered data. All of the examples are short sequences of touches or swipes. If a screen is used too heavily, I suspect anything useful gets lost in the increasing overlay of fingerprint smudges. The very recommendation made by the researchers to use an alphanumeric password where possible, like the new option in Froyo, Android 2.2, seems to bear out my inference about the limits of this technique. Future work will look at other physical aspects of the touch screens. In particular, the article mentions thermal traces. Imaging latent heat would seem to be more resistant to loss, as the most recent use of the screen would be the clearest. Of course, the traces are far less durable than skin oil, so it's a different trade-off in terms of the feasibility of the attack. The researchers go on to question the wisdom of entering sensitive data using input devices where evidence is so readily apparent, as with touchscreens. The seeming resistance of soft keyboards suggests alternatives without having to switch to different kinds of hardware like a dedicated keyboard, like say the Motorola Droid has some other models of smartphones. Varying the placement of keys and simpler layouts for sensitive data, say on a random basis, would make after-the-fact recovery from smudges or heat that much harder. All the same, it reminds us that such significant shifts in technology expose latent ambiguities and new risks that weren't apparent with the old. I'm glad this research was shared relatively early in the popularity of these devices. There are tons of touchscreen smartphones out there and other devices that bear touch screens for input, but the growth rate is increasing at the moment. Early adopters are also accustomed to regular software updates. It seems like a good time to consider these sorts of findings, beefing up security accordingly, and making sure that it's available before there's really a true explosion in the use of touch screens. The last story I wanted to talk about is actually a video on the future of 3D printing. This was sent to me by a reader and listener, Ken, who shared a link to it. It's a presentation by industrial designer Scott Summit given at the Singularity University on the topic of 3D printing. The video is hosted, not surprisingly, by Adafruit Industries, an innovative company in the maker and DIY space. Summit lays out traditional manufacturing, both its advantages in terms of supporting innovation and its limitations that customization is much harder to pull off. In other words, it doesn't mesh well when there is a greater need to match a produced good with an individual's need. The example he uses is limb prosthetics, something that later on in the video he circles back to and talks about as a main component of his regular work. His answer was to combine 3D scanning, parametric modeling, and 3D printing. He gives a good explanation of what each of these is, and the course of doing so actually kind of does a sort of a state of 3D printing today, as well as hinting at what may come with advances in the technology and dropping prices. And it's interesting to see how these three elements actually complement and fit together. He explains both the really high-end approaches, like what he uses professionally, as well as touching on the more DIY approach, cobbling together commodity parts with interesting, powerful, and cheaper free software. What is surprising, at least for scanning and modeling, is that the physical scale is less of a limit than you would think. He has examples of buildings and even cities being scanned and modeled. He gives an equally accessible explanation of parametric modeling, what he actually means by that. Mostly, it's driven by the need to scale complex changes, so that tweaking a single parameter actually affects a complex of interrelated elements. As he says, it pushes the hard work on the computer rather than the designer having to custom build all of those individual elements and changing and making one-off models. I hadn't really thought about that impact of modeling when it comes to 3D printing. He explains how a non-expert user can leverage the computer to alter designs to do customization on demand to meet highly individualized or context-based needs without having to be a designer, an architect, or any other kind of specialist. The material production really then, if you think about it, is just a consequence of that lower cost of design. Customization becomes effectively free, as he puts it. The new design approach eliminates the difference between a stock version of an object and a highly tricked out one. The example he uses is a luxury car. If you were to produce, say, a Mercedes sedan entirely out of 3D printed parts, that would eliminate a lot of that cost of customization. As he goes on later to talk about, there are many cases where you can actually print the complexity right into the object, eliminating a lot of the just-so assembly costs. Really, the improvements in 3D design modeling and coupling it with cheaper and cheaper 3D printing lowers the cost of complexity, whatever the original source of that, not just arising from building custom objects, but pushing the envelope on sophisticated designs just for their own sake. He gives example of a design that no other technique could produce. That's actually something he revisits repeatedly in the latter half of the video. I like that he discusses both utility goods, like architecture and clothing, as well as art. Summit ties imagination to design in an instantiation. Another aspect he explores is the set of new behaviors, specifically creating a marketplace for 3D printing on demand. And he talks about Shapeways and another online market. Even before we can each have our own desktop 3D printers that are effective ways, there are effective ways to share access to the lowering cost of producing tangible goods with these technologies. The video is almost a full hour, but I encourage you, if you're interested in 3D printing at all, to give it a watch. It's well worth it. His presentation is filled with examples for all his different points. The latter half of the presentation is dedicated to two case studies where he goes more in depth on a couple of his projects from his professional life that use 3D scanning, modeling, and printing. Overall, no matter what your interest in this space, I almost guarantee you you're going to find some aspect of his talk that's going to be appealing to you. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've talked about before, and I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. The only story I wanted to follow up on, and I wanted to spend a little more time on it, is news of what Verizon and Google actually were up to a couple of weeks ago. This past week, they announced a joint policy framework for network neutrality that they've been working on in all of this time. And I guess some leakages of this are what formed the basis of the New York Times story that I talked about in the last news show. As the public policy blog at Google explains, they see this as a continuation of collaborative work and discussion with Verizon on the issue of network neutrality. That included a joint statement on the principle last year and jointly filing comments to the FCC's notice of inquiry earlier this year. They pretty clearly identify the two main elements of the discussion. On the one hand, preserving choice and openness that enables innovation on the internet. On the other, ensuring there is sufficient opportunity to realize enough value online to fuel the growth of broadband infrastructure and access to it. The proposed framework is laid out in 2 pages and is surprisingly concise if you actually want to read the whole thing. It's linked to from the public policy blog post. It can be laid out along 7 key elements, and there's a good summary in the blog post itself of these, and that is consumer protections, non-discrimination requirement, that's kind of the heart of the idea of neutrality, transparency, network management, additional online services, wireless broadband, case-by-case enforcement, regulatory authority, and broadband access for Americans. Overall, my impression is this is largely a non-statement. It's up to the FCC to do anything with this, after all. It is unlikely that Verizon or Google will act on this without some buy-in from the commission itself, from the federal agency responsible, in the absence of anybody else from the government stepping forward for doing something in this space. So, as they say, it really is just a move to advance the debate. The problem is that I think it simply doesn't. It's riddled with loopholes and weak solutions. The recommended role for the FCC is incredibly constrained. The additional online services is essentially a way for an ISP to classify any offering as such and bypass any of the rest of the obligations in the framework. It even carries forward this this flawed idea of reasonable network management. And now, that sounds practical, that sounds sane, but the problem is that it's so vague as to be meaningless. Any ISP, any carrier can do whatever they want and basically call it reasonable network management, and there's just not enough definition there to say what is and isn't. The proposal makes noises about recognized standards and shared governance principles, but there aren't really any already in existence, and there's no incentive provided here for their development. Once again, it's a label that can be slapped on borderline behavior, calling it some sort of a standard, a standard in flux, even worse, as an excuse for that behavior. Even the suggested transparency doesn't go far enough, in my opinion. It would add a Schumer box, if you will, like that nutritional information here in the U.S. that you see on your grocery store shelves, adding that to services, but not requiring any hard operational data over time. That's another dimension that I think is absolutely critical here to providing a feedback loop into any regulations to make sure that they stay on target and appropriately light in depth and effect. There is some information of this caliber already on consumer broadband packages, but they are often meaningless, really, because they assume burst speed or other ideal capacity without any practical data on how packages really perform over time. Worst of all is that wireless is effectively exempt under this proposal, the reasoning being that it is too early days. Now, they do, in the wording, leave room to come in and revisit it, but out of the gate, none of the principles they're proposing would be immediately applied to wireless broadband. That's utter bunk, as we've seen the same issues arise regardless of carrying capacity or the low-level differences in the actual medium. Wireless isn't that different. There is an op-ed in the Washington Post from the CEOs of both companies further explaining the proposal, or supposedly explaining it, but in skimming over it, it really doesn't add much beyond the proposal itself, or really even the summary blog post up at the public policy blog. There is a load of analysis of the proposal already. You can't swing a virtual cat without hitting somebody's post from this past week looking at this policy framework. Not surprisingly, I'm going to recommend the one from EFF. By and large, Cindy Cohn agrees with some of the troubling aspects that I see. She's a bit more charitable on some points, like limiting FCC authority. That's been a sore point with the EFF, and I understand the reasoning here. Certain potentialities, some possibilities that might arise from standard bodies. Google has a content-free response that they released later in the week to a lot of the early criticism. Speaking more charitably, they could fully believe this proposal is sound. What it does is highlight how hard it is to agree on most aspects of network neutrality. They haven't done more than issue a statement on what they think would work. Lots of people have comparable or conflicting views on what would work. That's the problem, is we have a lot of opinion and not a lot of hard data and empirical fact. Maybe they think a framework stronger than a statement might lighten the load of regulation, the same sort of self-regulation practice that has worked in other industries. I doubt that until we can get to some agreement on core principles, like what really is reasonable network management in a clearly defined way, in a concrete and auditable fashion, then we are just chasing our tails on this issue. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend, or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, you can find details of my public key pair at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next show, which should go out in the feed Wednesday as usual, will be a feature cast with a new inner chapter on the topic of scalability. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is made from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you can do what you like with the content as long as you tell folks where you got it and you share your changes under the same terms.